Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, Scott Horton Show. Check out the archives, 4,000-something interviews at scotthorton.org and at libertarianinstitute.org. And hey, this one is dedicated to the memory of our friend Will Grigg, who died just the other day. It's our other good friend, the great Gareth Porter, writing again for truthout.org. New revelations belie Trump claims on Syria chemical attack. You don't say. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks, Scott. Glad to be back again.
Very happy to have you on. Hey, before we start talking about all the facts in your article and stuff, I wanted to point out a thing that I was thinking in my brain. And it went like this. Boy, you better be right to not believe this thing, because then later you're going to look like a real jackass if it turns out that Bashar al-Assad and his government really did do this, and you're the thing. And this is how social psychology works. Look at the profound consensus. Everybody is so sure. And I know I'm the one out on a limb for not believing. But it's not like that works on me or anything. I'm just saying my brain does fire those neurons, same as everybody else. We feel that pressure to go along with the received wisdom. But I know better. I know. I just need to wait around, and Gareth Porter's going to pick this thing apart for me. So,
Well, you're absolutely right, Scott. I mean, there's no doubt that the consensus in the country, political consensus, media consensus, does make a difference. It weighs on everybody to one degree or another. I mean, I have to consider it. I mean, of course, absolutely. The thought occurs that you better be right, because otherwise, you know, you'll suffer attacks because of this is going to be, if they're going to pounce on it with every ounce of strength. So it absolutely makes a difference. And and in some sense, it's good, because it makes one more cautious about one's analysis. Mm-hmm. And you should be cautious. You damn well better make sure you're getting it right.
Right.
And that's the good side of it. The bad side of it is that for most people, it prevents them from even entertaining the thought that it might be different from the consensus.
Right. Well, you know what? If there's one thing about the 21st century, by now, I think it's just fair that, never mind people with alternative political ideologies or anything else, I think it's just right for every American to feel like we don't have to believe them. You know what? A lot of the times, the things that they say about why we need to bomb people, it turns out it's just not true. The Maine, the Lusitania, Pearl Harbor, the Gulf of Tonkin. For that matter, I always skip the North Korean attack on the South, which was really the other way around there. So the green light for Saddam to invade Kuwait, the weapons of mass destruction, the fake sarin attack from 3.5 years ago, Gareth, Gaddafi's promise to annihilate every man, woman, and child in the eastern half of his country in 2011. The 100,000 people who'd already been murdered in Kosovo, according to Bill Clinton in 1999. It turns out that actually, geez, I don't even think I'm done yet, but I'll go ahead and stop.
You're not. You know, the fact is, Scott, that every single one of the rationales for the use of force that the United States has given have been, to one degree or another, simply a lie. I mean, that's the reality. And that is why you're absolutely right, that it's not just, it's not just a good idea for people to doubt. It's really incumbent on people to doubt, not to give the benefit of the doubt to the government, but exactly the opposite. Force them to prove their argument before you accept it.
Right. All right. Well, and this is, of course, your specialities. You take their claims and then you hold them up to the light. So here we go. There's a town. It's in Syria. a bunch of people died of something. And other than that, nobody agrees. The U.S., and I guess its allies say that, well, in the U.S., that's a pretty general term, too. You can parse that if you want, Gareth. But the U.S. says, the official statement of the government is that Assad did it. He dropped a bomb on this town. He gassed these people with sarin, and he's guilty. And that's why Donald Trump launched this cruise missile strike, etc. And then there's the other side of the story, the Syrian government and the Russians and their claims. And then there's a whole lot of gray area and leaks and claims and counterclaims and debunkings all over the place here. So this is where I turn it over to you to help us get it all straight.
Well, where to start? I mean, I think that there are two key points on which the Trump administration, these two unnamed officials, who, I, by the way, I feel fairly confident that it's Votel and Mattis, who are the unnamed senior officials who briefed the media 3 days ago now. And the reason is that those are clearly the two officials who have been most deeply involved in talking with the White House about what to do about this, how to handle it, and so forth. They're the ones who've been most immersed in the details. It would make total sense for those two to be the ones who briefed the media. By the way, they both gave an on-the-record press conference at the Pentagon, not on the on the issue of the what happened in Khan Shaykhun, but rather on U.S. military policy in the Middle East that same day. So they are a team. They work together. I have no doubt they're the ones who have perpetrated yet again a fiction on the American people over this incident. And what they told the press in their briefing had two major points as I analyze it. One was that the Russians came up with this cockamamie idea that the Syrians were carrying out a strike, were going to carry out a strike, and did carry out a strike against a warehouse that they suspected had toxic chemicals in it, only after the fact. They tried to make the case that it was only after the fact. They claimed that some Syrian source, unnamed, had told Russian media that in fact the Syrian Air Force didn't carry out any strikes that day in that town. We don't know anything more about that, but that was and then they claimed that it was simply something that the Russians were doing to cover up the reality. So that was the first point. Then the other one is that they had identified the source of the sarin gas that killed dozens of people, as many as 100, according to the story. 50 to 100 people. And it was a crater in the road, in the middle of the road, which is the subject of a number of videos, which some of your listeners may have already seen online. And so they said, you know, we know that this is where the chemicals came from that killed all these people. It wasn't from the warehouse that the Russians claim the Syrians hit. So that's the storyline that they peddled to the media. And of course, it was lapped up without any serious questioning, without any effort to fact check or anything of the sort. But what I found and what I said in my article that was published last night, yesterday evening, is that they were completely wrong or presumably wrong, demonstrably wrong in both of these instances. In the case of the story about the plan to hit the warehouse, we now know that that the Russians actually informed the U.S. military in Syria 24 hours before the strike took place that the Syrians were going to carry out such a strike, that it would be targeting the warehouse that they had reason to believe had toxic chemicals in it. Now, that is based on a source who is well connected with people in the intelligence community, particularly so with someone who is in the U.S., in U.S. military intelligence in the Middle East, and who is familiar with this episode of the of how the Russians used the deconfliction line, which I think people are familiar with. The deconfliction line was intended to prevent an accident between Russian and American planes in Syria. They warn one another when either of them is planning a flight that could potentially be the cause of some sort of an accident.
Well, so, now, is there a specific counterclaim there that, no, they did not call us before they launched this airstrike? Because that would be highly unusual if they did not call them over this deconfliction line before launching any airstrike, right?
I think that's true. You know, I'm not sure of that, but I think it's true that...
But the Americans aren't disputing and saying they didn't call us. That's one of the suspicious things.
They're not disputing it. Of course, if they disputed it, then they would admit the story that it's true that the Russians have said that, and they're not acknowledging it. So, of course, they simply ignored the whole point of that story. They're covering it up, essentially, is what I'm trying to say. But they did, in fact, try to suggest that there was no evidence of any strike on a warehouse. They did not make that statement flatly, but the entire briefing that they gave was an effort to suggest that there was no such strike. However, this is one of the things that, you know, boggles my mind about this briefing. There is a paper that has been circulating in Washington that has, as far as I know, I have not seen it. I've not seen a URL for it, but I have seen references to this paper. I've seen the text of it, and in this paper, it's an unattributed. Well, it says it has a title something like, you know, the strike in Hansekun of April 4th, but there's no attribution. There's no authorship attributed to it, and in this paper, it's clearly a paper that circulated within the intelligence community and in the administration. In this paper, there is a specific reference to a Syrian airstrike on a warehouse which is said to be located, as I recall, in eastern Hansekun, in the eastern suburbs of the city. So we know that they are aware that there was such a strike. Okay, we know that from that paper. And yet they chose to try to deny that there was any strike on a warehouse in Hansekun. That to me is a very telling point. Okay, that's the first point. Mm-hmm. Second point is that their supposed certainty that this crater in the road with a hulk of metal in it is the source of the chemical that's supposedly the sarin that killed all these people is certainly highly questionable, because we now know from our friend Ted Postol, who is a brilliant analyst and just is absolutely unstoppable. You can throw virtually any problem at him and he'll come up with
scientist from MIT.
He is a rocket
debunked,
scientist.
He debunked the sarin attack story last time and backed up Seymour Hersh against the trolls thing.
And he did so because of his powerful knowledge of how various rockets and missiles work. And he's able to analyze these things. So in this case, he was able to look at this rusted, not, I don't want to say rusted, this hunk of metal, this remnant of something, and say, well, this is not a standard issue missile or rocket that is used by the Syrian Air Force. In fact, it's an improvised device that is not something that would be fired from an airplane. And he was able to show that it shows evidence of having an explosive on top of it, meaning that it was located in the crater, or it was located someplace on the ground where there was an explosive on top of it, which blew it open or mashed it down, is the way he put it. Didn't blow it open, but mashed it down, mm-hmm. and forced the sarin out through the end, like, as he put it, like toothpaste from a toothpaste tube.
The presumed sarin, right? Because doesn't he say that there's still actually no real reason to think that there was actually any sarin in that tube necessarily, just that absolutely. Somebody set off a bomb in the road. That's with absolutely a tube.
Right. There are two levels or three levels here that are involved in this issue. One is whether this weapon was in fact an air launched or ground launched weapon, and he makes it very clear it was not an air launched weapon. It would have to be done from the ground. Two is you know, whether that weapon actually fired, you know, whether it was actually used in that place. And three is whether it actually was sarin that came out of it if it was used. And these are all three different questions that he addresses. The first one, he does not address the other two. He's not expressing any certainty or any mm-hmm. strong view on the other two questions. Yeah. And I have to add that this question of whether it was sarin or not is of particular interest to me, because I have been, for the last year or more, have been looking at the evidence of whether previous so-called sarin attacks were in fact sarin or not. And I am reasonably convinced that in either none or in only very few of these cases were they in fact sarin attacks. I believe that they were, that the chemicals that were used, that have been used in Syria, have been weapons that use smoke that was converted into phosphine gas by contact with moisture in the air, or which weapons were actually based on emitting phosphine gas. Now, we know that ISIS has in fact come up with some weapons or a weapon which is based on pumping phosphine gas into a barrel and then firing it out or emitting it. So you know, my view, based on all the research I've done, I won't get into more detail on it, is that most or all of these so-called sarin attacks have in fact been something else. They are based on a phosphine gas which mimics the symptoms and the signs and symptoms of a sarin attack, but it's much less lethal. It only kills, generally speaking, it only kills if you have been exposed to the gas in a very confined space, which of course was the case with at least 29 of those who died, potentially a majority of those who died in Khan Sheikhoun. They were 29 members of a single family were killed because they were in a basement, which was filled up with this gas, or you know, where the gas came in. So it was much more lethal there.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for Rye Guys T-shirts. Rye Guys, that's WRYGuys.com. Great, irreverent, thought-provoking T-shirts upholding a pro-freedom perspective. Inspired by such classic humorists as Mark Twain, H.L. Mencken, and Oscar Wilde, they invoke the wit and wisdom of the past to satirize modern myths. These high-quality shirts for men and women look good and feel good, and they make great gifts. Use the coupon code SCOTT for 15% off. Rye Guys T-shirts at RyeGuys.com. That's WRYGuys.com. And now, what are these reports that the Al-Qaeda guys had kidnapped, or maybe even not Al-Qaeda, but there's this other group very close to Al-Qaeda there, I forgot their name, that supposedly had kidnapped a bunch of villagers from a neighboring area a week before, and that maybe they were the victims here in some kind of, you know, like,
yeah, I saw that.
Maybe the thing was more of a setup than an accident kind of a scenario.
Yeah. I don't know anything more about it. I haven't really tried to get into that one, to tell you the truth. I'm not in a position to say, no, that's not true, but I certainly don't regard it as a necessary to an explanation, obviously, of this, of what happened.
Mm-hmm. I can say that on this show, I guess I could check the date as long as I'm talking about it, but this is the day of the missile strike, the day of the Tomahawk strike, before the Tomahawk strike, I interviewed Philip Giraldi, the former CIA officer, who I know that you're very familiar with.
Yep.
And he told me on this show that he had intelligence and military sources who were basically backing up the Russian narrative here, that they hit this warehouse and some gas was in there. I don't know if it was sarin or not, but that seems to be what happened.
Well, I mean, there's an additional detail which I have in my article, which also backs this up, although in an incomplete way, and that is an eyewitness report of an attack on a one-story building by the Syrian planes, or a Syrian plane, I should say, and which created a mushroom cloud, according to the eyewitness, a 14-year-old girl who was on her way to study the Quran, and then turned around and went back home, which was very, very near there. So she was up. She was very close to the building that was hit. She was within a few hundred yards of the building that was hit, a few dozens of yards, I should say, not hundreds, dozens of yards, is the way she put it. And she saw then in her neighborhood. After she went back home and was safely inside, she saw the people who arrived in the neighborhood to help others succumb to the poison gas, to the toxic gas. So that, in fact, suggests to me that it does seem likely. It seems to me most likely that indeed the poison gas, whatever it was, whether it was sarin, I think was much more likely to be something different. I think it was a phosphine gas of some sort, was the cause that is the attack, the bombing of this warehouse with that gas in it was the cause of the sickness and or the illness and deaths that we saw in Kansai-kun. Mm. That seemed to be more likely than not at this point.
Yeah, I mean, that sure makes a lot more sense than the Syrians decided. Well, I mean, we could get into the whole context of the fact that they've been winning in recent days against al-Nusra and that kind of thing anyway, and the politics of the talks that were supposed to start the next day or 2 days later in Brussels and all this and all the political reasons why Assad had no real reason to do this. But then we're supposed to believe that when they launched this gas attack, they dropped one gas bomb and they hit in the middle of the road out in this sort of agricultural / industrial park kind of a thing on the outskirts of this town. And then that the gas from that one bomb then inundated this entire town and killed almost 100 people. But nobody has any pictures of the big cloud rolling in from, you know, the other neighborhood across the road or anything. You know what I mean? The whole thing doesn't make sense at all on the face of it.
There is this one video which is taken at ground level close to a cloud moving along at a fairly rapid pace. Now, my friend Pierre Spray tells me that, you know, look, you don't know whether that is in fact Kansai-kun or not, even though the voice says this is Kansai-kun, but it does seem to be the kind of toxic or the kind of thing that looks like the toxic cloud that could have killed people, and it looks like.
Well, so has Bellingcat tried to place all the landmarks in the picture and say that this is next to the hole in the road or not?
Well, they have some sort of an analysis of that. They did that right off the bat, but it doesn't – what they showed, as I recall it – I haven't looked at it for a while now, but as I recall it, it didn't really prove anything. It certainly was not an analysis that had any power to indicate, you know, whether the gas that killed – people actually came from that hole in the road or not. They didn't even claim that they were doing that. So I think the answer to the question generally is no.
Well, and is it, how do you say it? Postal?
Ted Postal, yes.
Postal. Did he mention about whether The bomb should have exploded in the air if it was a gas dispersal bomb rather than explode on impact with the street. And whether, I mean, is that part of his analysis of why?
Well, I mean, the general point of view of people who work on gas, I should say chemical weapons, is that the effective way to do it is to have an explosion above the ground. I mean, that's the way you disperse it effectively. that's the most effective way. And, his position is clearly that this was exploded on the ground, not in the air. So, he's suggesting that it was not. I mean, he's very firm in his conviction that this was not an air launched chemical weapon.
Mm-hmm. All right, now Garrett. So, what about this? All the story where it was intelligence sources at first came out and said, oh, we think now that the Russians must have known about this chemical attack because they share a base and for whatever other reasons. And then later the military and then even the Secretary of State explicitly walked that back when he was in Russia. But there was a pretty big story about that in the first place.
Yeah, the story that I'm familiar with, Scott, is there was an Associated Press story on April 10th, that quotes an unnamed senior U.S. official saying that the Russians had a drone flying or hovering over the city of Khanshekhun, where the so-called hospital was located, where some people were brought for treatment on the day of the attack or of the incident, shall we call it the incident, for the moment at least. And so the argument by this senior U.S. official is that the Russians had visual evidence that the Syrians were attacking the victims of their own sarin attack, people who were going for treatment. So they knew all along that the Syrians had carried out this attack. Now, of course, that's a tortured argument because it's based on the assumption that there was, in fact, a sarin attack by the Syrians and that whatever happened at that hospital, that so-called hospital, whether it was a real hospital or not, I'm not sure, was a direct result of the sarin attack that the Syrians carried out. So the whole thing was just based on a whole pyramid of assumptions and is really worthless. That's all I can say about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, so I wonder what you think is next then. This is a bit far afield from your article, but so they did this strike, but then that was it. But then they said Assad must go, but then they said not that we're going to do anything about it. So is it just Barack, Trump here, same old policy as 1 year ago? Or has there been a significant change here, do you think?
There's been a significant change, but, it's a change that is shaped by two overriding considerations. The first one, and I'm not at this moment going to try to prioritize which one is the primary one in the view of the Trump White House. But clearly one of these overriding considerations is domestic politics. I mean, it's clear that Trump understood that by carrying out this strike and by posturing, a strong anti-Assad posture as well as anti-Russia posture, in doing so, he would redeem himself in the eyes of much of, if not all, of the U.S. news media and disarm his partisan critics. And that's exactly what, of course, has happened. So that is clearly one of the things that is behind the posture that has been struck in conjunction with this U.S. Airstrike, or, not airstrike, but missile strike against the base in Syria. But the other one is at least of equivalent importance politically, and that is the concern that this administration has about North Korea. I think that the Trump administration is really freaked out about North Korea. They think that unless they do something in the coming months, it will be impossible to stop North Korea from having a capability to go ahead with a program that will result in being able to hit the United States with a nuclear weapon. And therefore, they are they're convincing themselves that they have to get the Chinese to step in and essentially sit on the North Koreans. And the only way to do that, in their view, is to frighten the Chinese by convincing them that this administration is capable of carrying out a preemptive attack against North Korea unless the Chinese do something. And that is exactly the posture that the Trump administration has struck in recent days. And in fact, I would say in recent weeks, they've been sort of leading up to this. So I think that, that really goes a long ways toward explaining the dramatic turnaround in the political posture that they've struck about both Russia and the Assad regime in recent days.
Well, you know, I don't know. What if the Chinese say, well, no, we're not
Well, that's the question, you know? I mean, which I happen to think is the most likely outcome here. The Chinese, first of all, they've been played before, or at least the Obama administration tried to play them over over Iran. You know, they the Obama administration explicitly sent people to Beijing with the message that unless the Chinese can convince the Iranians that they've got to give in on the in the negotiations on the nuclear talks. Then the Israelis, we're afraid the Israelis are going to carry out a wage a war against Iran, and then all hell will break loose and we'll all be losers. So you better get in line and do something about the Iranians. And of course, that didn't work. And I think the Chinese are perfectly capable of seeing through this. And they know that the Trump administration is well aware that to wage war against North Korea would be a total disaster. So I don't think it's going to work. But I think that's what they hope will be the effect.
Yeah. But then, so as far as Syria goes, what all effect does this have on that? I mean, if they want to get away with this bluff against North Korea, don't they need to be getting along with the Russians too, not just the Chinese?
Well, logically, of course, they need to get along with the Russians. The problem that
I mean,
they
always need to get along with the Russians, no matter what the question is, of course. But
Yeah, but I think the real problem, the real threat here in the posture that we're talking about of saying that if there's another chemical strike, then we will we'll have to react again. That of course, is an invitation to the jihadist to pull another false flag attack, and so I'm very much afraid that that will be the effect of it, and so then we're all in the soup.
All right, well, but I mean, okay, so it comes down to it. Trump goes crazy. He starts listening to the Likudniks, and he says, "Fine, let's carpet bomb Damascus and get Assad out of there." Will Russia go to war to prevent that from happening?
Of course they will. Yeah, I mean, they'll have no choice. I don't think they'll have any choice. If the United States is going to use force to try to end the regime, that would be an intolerable affront to any major power, especially one that is led by somebody like Putin. So, yeah, I mean, my guess would
be... Even though to call the bluff means we all die anyway. All of us, including him.
There are a few steps in between, you know, a war between the U.S. and Syria, U.S. And Russia in Syria and nuclear war. I'm not saying that it's not a highly dangerous situation because it is, but, you know.
Yeah, I don't think we can have a limited war with Russia over Syria and then just leave it at that. I think once you start killing Russians in the air over anywhere or on the ground at their anti-aircraft sites or whatever it is, you're on a slippery slope. Now, did you ever read Andrew Coburn's book about Rumsfeld? And about how in the 1990s, they would do the practice exercises for the continuity of government and when the shadow government takes over, if DC gets nuked and whatever, this kind of thing. And Donald Rumsfeld would play the president and he would end up leading the entire world to total thermonuclear devastation every single time. And whenever there was a opportunity to say, okay, enough. No, they'd still just keep going. Revenge, you can't nuke our Denver. We're going to take out your St. Petersburg, and back and forth, and that's it. And it just keeps going until we're all dead. And it's basically designed that way. The University of Chicago eggheads, they made it so that it's so intolerably intolerable to have a nuclear war that we won't have one, except that what happens if the bluff is called?
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, this is the illogical logic of the nuclear age. But I'm not sure how that gives the United States assurance against not having a counter blow in Syria from the Russians. I don't think that's the case. I mean, I think that would be ridiculous.
Well, I mean, for me, it's a big reason not to try to test them and pick the fight. But then I also think, you know, I understand that Mr. Putin's got to be Mr. Macho up there because he's the Donald Trump of Russia and everything, you know, with his tough guy attitude and all that. But then again, at what cost save face? What if America really does? What if Donald Trump really does decide on regime change in Damascus? We're going to have a shooting war over that. I mean, ultimately, does Syria matter that much to Russia? I know they have their naval base there, and I know they don't want another jihadistan based out of Damascus.
Well, I mean, Syria doesn't matter that much to the Trump administration. I mean, let's face it. They don't give a rat's ass about Syria.
Well, that'd be fine with me, you know.
Yeah. I mean, they don't. And that's why I really don't think that that is in the cards. I mean, they're not talking about regime change. They're talking about, we want the world to take responsibility for the policy that they're talking about is the same one as the Obama administration. Okay. There's no difference.
Well, remember in 1998, Bill Clinton signed the Regime Change Act against Saddam that said, one day we'll get rid of him. And then, one day came. It's official policy. In fact, that's what the Bushies said all during early 2002 and 3. They said, hey, Bill Clinton is the one who signed the Regime Change Act. All we're doing
is just building
on this bipartisan consensus.
It was building on it. That's right. But now what I'm saying is that they have, having used military force, their regime change policy, quote unquote, goes back to what the Obama administration was saying. Mm-hmm. That is that, we need to have an agreement with the Russians to have a settlement which will somehow dispose of the problem of Assad. That's very different from saying we're going to bring about regime change militarily. I can't see that that's where they're headed at all. They're explicitly not saying that is what I'm trying to get across.
Yeah. Well,
so
anyway,
for the time being, at least that
in the Obama years, Assad must go meant no, we're not going to carpet bomb Damascus, but yes, we're going to spend $1 billion a year sending jihadist mercenaries to suicide bomb you. So that's still pretty bad.
It's still pretty bad. Yeah, it's still pretty bad.
The confidence is high that that could actually never lead to regime change. That can just prolong the stalemate. Is that it?
Well, I mean, let's face it. I mean, they're supporting the opposition has been a farce. I know you're well aware that I thought that there was really that policy was finished under the Trump administration. Indeed, the fact that CENTCOM on the very day, as I recall, that the chemical incident took place in Khan Shaykhun, CENTCOM's spokesman, when asked about the chemical attack, said, well, that's not our department. We have no responsibility for the relationship between the opposition and the regime, which to me was another signal that the United States was out of the business of supporting the opposition in Syria. But all that has changed now, I guess. I mean, that appears to be the case. I don't know exactly what it means, but.
Well, we can never underestimate the fact that the CIA is its own empire and they do what they want anyway, right?
Well, they have done what they want in the past, I agree. But what, at least
Obama seemed to give up even trying to tell him what to do or not do anymore,
I think what that means is that he didn't have the backbone to stand up to them. He wasn't willing to say no. And the point is that if the president says no, then, he can make it difficult to impossible for the CIA to continue a policy that he opposes. But
if he's willing to try that hard.
Yeah, you got to have some backbone. That's all. Yeah. You got to have backbone.
Right. Well, or a little bit of background knowledge, right? So here we got Trump has got some backbone, but he doesn't even know where Syria is.
Well, I'm not even sure I would go along with the idea that he has backbone with regard to the military. He hasn't shown
me
that.
Well, no, that's true. I mean, only on a personal level if somebody offends him, right? So he decided he didn't like Mike Flynn anymore, even though Flynn wore medals, you know?
Exactly.
But the institutions themselves, no, they're the only interest group that he represents at this point. So
Exactly.
All right. Well, listen, I've kept you too long, but thank you so much for giving me some of your time again, Gareth. You do great work, as always.
Always a pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
All right. You guys, that is the great Gareth Porter. He wrote the book on Iran's nuclear program. It's called Manufactured Crisis, The Truth Behind the Iran Nuclear Scare. And he wrote 10 million great articles in the past for IPS News, for truthout.org, for Middle East Eye. And we republish virtually all of it at antiwar.com as well. The great Gareth Porter. And check out all of his interviews going back 10 years now. In the archives at scotthorton.org/interviews as well. Hundreds and hundreds. Literally 300, maybe more now. With the great Gareth Porter. I'm Scott Horton. Check out the full archives at scotthorton.org/interviews and at libertarianinstitute.org/scotthortonshow. And follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Oh, and the Q&A show. If you guys like the Q&A show, you can subscribe to that at scotthorton.org/show. And you can send me your questions on Twitter. Just use hashtag SHSQA, right? Scott Horton Show, questions, answers. Hashtag SHSQA, or just email me, scott@scotthorton.org, and I'll try to get to all y'all's foreign policy questions, too. And those, I also post all those on the blog at libertarianinstitute.org/blog as well. All right, that's enough. Thank you guys very much. Bye.
You drink coffee. I drink coffee. Just about everyone drinks coffee. So why bother with anything but the best? Darren's coffee is roasted at his new shop in Claremont, Indiana. And coming soon, you can order on Amazon and support the show by using Scott Horton's affiliate link. Darren'sCoffee.com. Because everyone deserves to drink great coffee.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.